Broadcasting live from the Wake Forest Business Radio X studios in North Carolina, it's time for Carolina Connections, the radio show where business leaders connect.
Good morning. This is Cal Hackeman, your host for Metro Raleigh Business Radio's Carolina Connections. We have Reed Powell with us this morning in the producer's chair. Hello, Reed.
Hey, how are you, Cal?
Doing great. Another beautiful morning in Wake Forest. We have a great show for you today here on Carolina Connections, where we talk to interesting business leaders in Raleigh and the surrounding area. So let's get busy and meet our guests and start learning about their businesses. Our first guest is Terry Conlon, who is the chair of Vistage CEO Advisory Board of the Triangle. That's a long title. We're going to have to work it on is. That one a little bit. So good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Cal.
Terry wears a number of hats depending on what his clients need, including being an executive coach, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, a fractional CFO, an interim CXO, and a project manager. He's a CPA, and he's held a variety of financial, logistics, information technology, and project management roles. So we have a lot to talk about with Terry.
Good deal.
Our second guest is Alicia Gillespie, partner at Smith Anderson, the largest law firm based in Raleigh. So that's a nice distinction, isn't it, Alicia?
It is. Hi, Cal. Thank you.
Alicia chairs the firm's Data Use, Privacy, and Security Practice Group and focuses on regulatory and transactional matters involving technology and data privacy law and licensing and outsourcing transactions. So that's another long spiel to explain what you do. She's a member of the Board of Advisors of the North Carolina Technology Association, known as NCTA. So good morning and welcome.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
And we're going to get right into it with Alicia. So Smith Anderson, the largest law firm based in Raleigh. How large? How long in Raleigh? What's the focus of the firm? Tell us about the firm.
Sure. So Smith Anderson has been around for about 102 years. We are a full service corporate and commercial law firm, and we have about 120, maybe 125 lawyers at this point. And we really do all things to help businesses, both on the M&A transactional side, commercial litigation, and everything in between, including data use, privacy, and security.
Well, that's great. And we're going to talk some more about that in just a little while. So when did you join the firm?
I joined the firm in 2008 and have really enjoyed being able to build a practice area in technology and data, which has been a huge growth area for legal services and for companies in general, I think, over the last 10 or so years in particular. And we've really enjoyed getting a bird's eye view of a variety of companies. Before I was in private practice, I was actually an in-house counsel for a technology company. And the private practice viewpoint is an interesting one and a broad perspective that we get.
So would you like to expand a little bit more on that, the difference between being in private practice and being in a law firm?
Well, from a lawyer's perspective, it's generally the difference between having to bill hours and not. I think from a market perspective, private practice lawyers often get to see a broader view of the market by representing a variety of companies, and that to me is the real challenge of private practice, and the thing that I enjoy the most is getting to represent multiple companies and seeing what they're all up to and looking at emerging business models and emerging technologies, which is really a focus of the practice area.
Absolutely. Terry and I are both CPAs, and so we both spent some time in public practice, so we understand that whole the excitement of the variety of serving lots of different clients, don't we?
Mm-hmm. You bet we do.
Let's talk a little bit about what types of matters you and the attorneys in your data use, privacy, and security practice group handle.
Sure. So I think people are probably hearing more about data use, privacy, and security these days. It's become much more of a mainstream issue. There have been a lot of headlines about data breaches over the past few years, and they seem to be increasing in frequency, and the number of large companies that are impacted by this issue seems to be increasing. So I hope our audience has some background in the area. We shape our practice a little broader than just data breaches, but I do want to talk about those in a few minutes. But really, I would say our practice focuses at the intersection of emerging information technologies and the host of regulations that protect consumer information in the United States. There are a patchwork of laws, regulations, and standards that have evolved in the United States that protect information about people, and those laws have evolved in iterations, and sometimes they are industry driven for the healthcare industry or for the payment processing industry or for the energy industry, and sometimes they apply just to specific types of data. And so what we're left with is a whole bunch of laws that might apply to one data set that might intersect and overlap and maybe contradict one another. And it creates some complexity in what companies can do with the data and what they must do to protect it. And it also, I think, has increased the potential risk in this area. And it's raised the attention of a lot of businesses.
So sort of one of your focuses is on privacy.
It is.
And, you know, everybody is really keyed into that, I think, these days. I mean, we certainly, you know, most of us run into that in the healthcare world, right?
That's right.
That's a big area, as you mentioned, the payment processing where, you know, I guess, you know, they can only get so much information from you and they can only use it in such or such a way.
Sure. Yeah, the healthcare industry is one industry that's really impacted by data privacy and data use laws and regulations. The primary law that people think about there is HIPAA, and there are other federal schemes that apply to those activities, and there are also state laws that can apply even in the face of HIPAA. That's just one example. Retailers who have been the subject of data breaches are bound by a variety of regulations that protect payment processing transactions and consumer cardholder data. The energy industry is facing regulations from the Federal Trade Commission and others because the smart grid technology that they use can amass a whole bunch of interesting and enlightening information about people's energy consumption, and that can that information can be useful to a variety of players, and so the industry is trying to make sure that that's not misused in any way.
Absolutely. So a lot of information out there. And you mentioned that you've been able to build a practice in this area, so I take it that this is a pretty fast-growing area for the firm?
It is. And so our practice really, the regulations I'm talking about are sort of the foundation of the practice, but the practice is really one that's about data and technology law and intellectual property and technology transactions. And so while we advise on sort of the regulatory compliance obligations for the regulations I just mentioned, we also work frequently where these laws intersect with the information technology that companies are using. And so companies are getting a lot of benefit from adopting new information technologies, whether it's
Absolutely.
Software as a service platforms, uh-huh. data hosting. And there are great efficiencies, there are cost savings on the front end, but there are risks associated with that because almost all of those technologies involve handing over your data to somebody else, handing over this regulated data to a third party and maybe others. But you still have the responsibility under the laws that I just talked about to protect that data. So it's a new world. There's a new landscape here of risk. Companies are reevaluating the way they've contracted for outsourced services.
Mm-hmm.
Vendors on the other side of this are coming into contact with an awful lot of data that can expose them to risk, but that can also be useful and valuable if they want to tap into it. So we're just seeing a whole bunch of new issues with people wanting to make novel uses of this data and also needing to protect it to protect themselves.
So where do all these clients come from? How do you get new clients? How have you grown your practice?
Sure. Some of it has grown organically within the firm. Smith Anderson historically represented a data mining company that was a joint venture in the life sciences space. And with that work, we learned an awful lot about how companies can access data and commercialize data products in healthcare and life sciences. And that was really a springboard for this practice area. Many of our healthcare and life sciences and retail clients have these issues, and so we are able to help them. We help companies of all sizes. So we help startups, emerging companies, mid-size, all the way up to Fortune 100s in this area. How do they get to us? Well, we do things like I'm doing today. We get out there and we talk about what we're learning and what we know. We're doing more and more of that because we want to make sure that we're educating people on this, for one thing. We think there's a lot of reservation about this issue in the market and maybe confusion and people getting very concerned and not really knowing what to do. But in general, we represent technology vendors, health information technology companies, and users of many types of technologies, data hosting companies, software as a service vendors, internet-based businesses. So it's an industry.
Cover the gamut.
We do. It's industry agnostic, and there's a wide range of people that we can help.
That's got to make it really, really interesting. So you mentioned data breaches.
Yes.
And we're certainly hearing a lot about data breaches. We won't necessarily mention any names here, but we've all heard the news reports, or we've gotten an email from somebody where we did a transaction saying, we're really sorry to let you know, but we think maybe your credit card information got compromised or whatever. So is this a trend that we're going to be hearing more about, or do you think that, you know, we're sort of going to get to a point where you know, retailers and other folks are going to kind of get it and get the protections in, and then this will kind of become old news. What do you think?
What do I think? Well, if I talk to my contacts in law enforcement and FBI, they seem to think that all of this is on the rise, and that the wrongdoers and the bad guys out there who are hacking and doing bad things with data, that's only going to increase. And so I don't think the risk is going to decrease anytime soon. I think awareness in the market is going to improve. I think some of these issues become cultural issues for companies. It's sea change. People need to revisit how they view their information technology resources and the activities that they're conducting with data, and taking a fresh look at that and really implementing some basic measures can help mitigate these risks. So I think the market is going to get better at addressing these issues once companies acknowledge that this issue is here to stay, and that there really needs to be a fresh look at IT budgets and other considerations at the C level to make sure the company's addressing these appropriately.
You know, we've heard a lot about taking a different look at IT departments, just like we've heard a lot about taking a different look at the financial parts of the organizations, which have historically been viewed as cost centers, right?
Absolutely.
And they're they don't necessarily have to be cost centers. They can be differentiators. You know, if your IT department can keep you from having a data breach, eventually that becomes something that maybe you dare to brag about.
Right.
Because that's something that consumers, you know, really, really are becoming very, very aware of. Are there any other trends that you're seeing that you think businesses should be aware of?
I think the trend is really the IT landscape has changed. I think that there are lots of great ways to outsource different functions within a company through cloud services or other software as a service platforms. And those are good cost-saving measures on the front end, but I think companies have to realize that they still need to manage the process along the way. And so vendor management is key here. You know, outsourcing and walking away is probably not the best approach. Making sure risk is appropriately allocated in contracts is a huge issue that we see coming up. The data regulatory schemes I talked about earlier really inform those negotiations in a new way. And so making sure those contractual terms are buttoned down and that there's appropriate management and a real understanding of what your vendors are doing, I think that's a trend and a real shift in the market.
And of course, those are all areas where you and your folks at Smith Anderson help people negotiate those agreements and nail those down. And
we sure do. Yeah, we have a big commercial component to our practice, helping people adopt these technologies within their companies and helping the vendors upfit their internal offerings through creative technology collaborations. Sure. That's one of our favorite things to do, actually.
Well, before I let you go, I just want to ask you, what should a company do in the event of a suspected or a confirmed data breach? What are like the top three things that you would say, you know, if this happens to you, you better do 1, 2, 3, and you better do it quick.
Right. So I think there are some best practices here that are simple enough and that can really help. The first thing is the company should educate its workforce on what a data breach is. It's not always clear. It's really the question of whether there's been a breach is a legal conclusion. Mm-hmm. And so educating folks on understanding when you suspect there's been an unauthorized disclosure of personal information, what that might look like and who to call is really key. Catching those things as early as possible can go a long way. And then once a company realizes that they may have had this type of incident, there is an investigation that usually must occur. There's not necessarily an immediate, oh, we've had a breach. There are several folks who need to weigh in on whether there's been a breach. And so technical teams need to weigh in on what happened. Lawyers need to weigh in on whether these breach notification laws have been triggered by the event. And often the marketing team, communications teams, and others are involved in this effort just so everybody's on the same page. And having that team assembled before a breach happens can also go a long way.
Absolutely.
In facilitating that type of investigation. And then, of course, complying with laws and the notification process is key, and trying to mitigate customer attrition from some of this, because the studies show that the retailers who've had massive breaches have lost customers through the course of this. And so understanding how to reassure your customer base when a breach has happened is very important. And that's where the communications and marketing team really can come in handy.
So investigate, figure out what happened, comply with the laws, and then figure out how to be upfront and you know, reassure people that you've got it under control, basically.
Right, and to have it under control.
Get it under control.
Absolutely.
Exactly. All right. Well, Alicia, if somebody wants to get in touch with you at Smith Anderson, how do they do that?
They can email me. My email is agilleski@smithlaw.com. That's a hard one to spell, but it's agilleski@smithlaw.com. My phone number is 919-821-6741.
Okay.
Thank you. And visit our website at smithlaw.com.
All right. Well, we'll be back. I'll be back in a little while. I want to talk to you about a couple other things that you do besides this group at Smith Anderson. But I want to switch over and talk to Terry. Thanks for waiting so patiently while I talked
with Alicia. Well, it was fascinating.
Well, good. I'm glad. So as I said in your introduction, you are a man with many talents, but one of those talents that we're going to talk a lot about today is executive coaching.
Yeah.
So what is executive coaching?
Yeah, so what executive coaching is, it's an individual who's skilled in the practice of coaching people who helps them achieve better business performance. I mean, that is it, pure and simple. And while it's very simple, it's not very easy, because sometimes there's people who misunderstand coaching as being some form of therapy, which it is not. So it's just improving your business performance in a way that maybe your boss or your peers can't work out for you.
So this is something that just the people at the top of the company should be worrying about?
Well, it's something that the people at the top of the company get the resources for, most typically, but everybody's performance can be significantly improved. I mean, one of the things that me and some friends talk about a lot is the fact that experience alone is a horrible teacher, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, you are able to learn from a leadership point of view, from a management point of view, technical issues. But if you have somebody who has the ability to intervene and focus your efforts better, then you're just going to be a better leader. You're just going to be a better manager. And so one of the things I think is going to be happening over the course of the next 4, 5, 6 years is as millennials take more and more of a leadership role, the way to accelerate their performance is by injecting coaching resources into their leadership development.
And the millennials we know are anxious to get to the top.
They absolutely are, and I'm anxious to help them get there.
That's terrific. So is executive coaching always done one-on-one, or can it be done in a group setting?
No, you can do it in a group setting, and the dynamics change a little bit. Most typically, I've seen it range from 5 people in a group to 15 people in a group, which sounds kind of extreme, but as long as you bring the right kind of process, the right kind of facilitation skills, I can see it being done that way. In fact, one part of my practice as a coach is that I'm a chair of a Vistage group, and we assemble 15 CEOs into a group for a day for them to focus on improving their business in certain very, very well-defined ways. And you would ordinarily think that that is lion tamer work, whip and chair stuff, right? But but actually, people of that caliber can be surprisingly disciplined in terms of focusing in on improving their business if that's their only opportunity for meaningfully doing so.
Absolutely. Well, I'm curious, how many people get coaching through their employers?
Very few nowadays.
Very few.
There are some companies that are very best practice employers in the triangle. Cisco has used it before. Citrix uses it. And a few other prominent companies, but it tends to be part of the performance and pay package for very, very high level C-level executives and for CEOs. Mm-hmm. It tends to not be standard, but it needs to be cascaded down in order to reduce time to market for people who improve business performance for their teams.
So does that mean that individuals are seeking out executive coaches on their own in order to improve their performance?
In some cases, yes. If somebody becomes aware of the fact from a development point of view that their promotion from a director level to a VP level hinges on performing in a very, very specific way in the next 3 to 6 months, oftentimes they will seek out coaches to improve that particular aspect. It might have to do with intra-team communication being better. It might have to do with improving multi-site management and and direction. Whatever it is, it makes a great deal of sense for them to invest, and people are starting to do so.
And so how do you find these people?
Yeah, with great difficulty. Currently, there's an organization called the International Coach Federation, ICF.org. Is a source of that, and they provide coaching, both life coaching as well as business coaching. My focus is purely on business coaching.
Okay.
And oftentimes some people advertise, and so you can Google them. So if people have a great deal of interest, I'm always willing to talk about the process of coaching and executive coaching. They can reach me, and I'll provide contact information later on.
Sure. Well, I suspect that there's a difference in the techniques that you use when you're coaching between, let's say, the millennials and the boomers.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that, or maybe give us a couple of examples of what would be different?
Yeah. So to my way of thinking, oftentimes when you're coaching boomers, you're coaching people at the end of their paid careers, right? Because there's oftentimes a second act in terms of nonprofit or board participation, but you're coaching people at the very end of their careers, and as a result, there's a limitation on your ability to improve a specific discrete area of responsibility. Whereas millennials are absolutely thirsty for improving their techniques in a very short period of time. So there's a degree of impatience associated with their learning. So I find it very exciting to deal with people who are very thirsty to want to do more and sooner and faster.
What's the typical frequency for executive coaching sessions? I mean, is this a weekly thing, a monthly thing?
I think the best format for one-on-one executive coaching is quite frankly, not less than once a month. I think that the best way to concentrate the hours is really to do it on a biweekly basis in two-hour chunks, because this is not sort of tactical updating, what have you done in the last 2 weeks? This is, what are you specifically working on and what are you specifically getting in terms of results? So I would say 4 hours a month is really the minimum in order to get significant performance increase.
So you're really dealing with their real life ongoing situations and giving them input and saying,
absolutely,
this is how you might do this better.
That's
this
right.
This is something that's worked.
You're talking to them about how they interact with their boss, how they communicate with their boss, how they communicate with their peers. If they and two peers, for example, are up for a promotion and only one's going to get that promotion, how are they going to deal with the disappointment if they're going to be the ones who are disappointed? Right. That has to be very professionally managed in any kind of company.
Sure, absolutely. Are there other groups of folks that we might compare and contrast similar to the boomers and the millennials that where you feel like there are really differences in the way that you would go about doing it?
Yeah, not so much in the way that you'd go about doing it, but one of the recent changes, one of the recent developments in coaching and business is that men have traditionally been the beneficiaries of a lot of coaching, and it's only been very recently that women are coming to the fore in this as well. I'd be interested when we have the round table later on to have Alicia comment on this. But men have had an advantage because they've been wired in. Once they get to a C level, coaching happens as a matter of course.
Sure.
It just does.
Sure.
But because there's fewer percentage-wise women at C level, they haven't been able to take advantage of this. And I think that there's not just from a marketing point of view an untapped market, but from a leadership point of view, there's a significant amount of gain to be had, mm-hmm. especially for women executives to adopt this.
Well, especially since I believe the statistics are that more than 50% of the startup companies are run by women these days.
That's right.
So, you know, women are coming on strong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is an issue that's near and dear to my heart, so I do want to pick this back up during the round
table. We can talk offline about
yes.
it, too.
Yeah. Great. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I was going to actually, my next question was just going to be to kind of bring this all back to the show was, you know, you've talked about coaching in the corporate environment. Do you coach in the professional services environment, like attorneys and CPAs? And
yeah, in fact, some of the Vistage work that I do involves having attorneys, like any other business profession, involves having CPAs, involves having engineers, in addition to a construction company or to a technology company. So in that kind of group coaching situation, there's a lot of diversity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you mentioned being chair of the Vistage, am I saying
mm-hmm.
that correctly?
Yep.
Vistage CEO Advisory Board of the Triangle. So mm-hmm. can you talk a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about Vistage. Vistage is a company that is the largest company in its category in the United States, the category being CEO Advisory Groups. And it was formed originally in Milwaukee in 1957. And the business idea behind it was an executive needing to have more unbiased advice to help him grow his business. And so he just started recruiting some friends who were not necessarily in his business, but they were in his shoes, meaning they were CEOs. And so because he was having a hard time getting objective advice, he assembled friends who all of a sudden started adopting this for their business, and it started growing very organically. When it came time for him to retire, he decided that he'd sell his business and he would start a business providing CEO advisory services, but he would move to San Diego to do so.
Mm.
So the company is currently
headquartered in a little different climate between
Milwaukee
and
that's
San
right.
Diego. I think I can see why he would want to go to San Diego.
That's right. And there it is to this very day. There's currently 18,000 Vistage members in the United States, and so it has grown organically very, very well. The other interesting thing from a business performance point of view is that Dun & Bradstreet did an analysis last year of Vistage member companies and non-Vistage member companies, and Vistage member companies were able to grow their top line by more than a factor of 2x, so more than 200%. So if somebody else was growing at 6%, they were growing at 12%. And the reason for that is not just because Vistage has some special secret sauce, but the kind of companies that are led by people who are willing to dedicate themselves one day a month to their own personal leadership development and business problem solving, those kinds of companies outperform people who are not willing to do so.
Sure, they
right?
get better.
They get
yep.
better, and they get better
Absolutely.
Faster.
Yep.
and they become more innovative.
So you mentioned bringing sort of 15 folks together to do this. What's a typical day like when you bring them together?
Yeah, so I'm going to be in one tomorrow downtown in Raleigh. But what happens is that there's a guest speaker who's brought in who's absolutely top flight guest speaker on a particular topic. Let's say it might have to do with employment law, or it might have to do with Alicia's area of expertise in terms of data privacy and legal issues around that. And it's not so much a speech as it is a workshop going through what are the best practices, number one, and then sort of company by company, who is well short of best practices, who has adopted a lot of the best practices, and so it serves as a wake-up call for a lot of people to say they need to be doing some things differently, right? So that's number one. And then there's an executive session. What the executive session consists of is a very intense problem-solving activity. And what that means is that you might have a significant problem that one CEO brings to the table that is widely applicable to everybody else. It might have to do with transition planning, executive succession, because a lot of these companies are privately held family companies. And that can be a very traumatic experience if not handled properly.
Yep.
So regardless of that, somebody brings to the table a problem statement that says, I'm having a problem with X. And so as a result, everybody else, in a highly facilitated, focused way, brings their point of view and asks clarifying questions, because everybody with a reasonable amount of experience in business knows that a problem well-defined is a problem half-solved,
right? Yep.
It just is.
Absolutely.
Now, the power of this technique really rests in the fact that when you have made a commitment to 15 peers that you've known for a little bit of time that you're going to take some action on something, you don't want to come back the next month and say that you chickened out, you did not take the action because it was too hard, or because you had the power to absolve yourself from having to do so because you're the owner-founder, right?
Yep.
So that kind of executive peer pressure really lights a fire under a lot of people in terms of getting a lot of things done that are ordinarily very, very difficult.
Sounds like a great experience and a great group to be part of.
Oh, it's superb.
Before we go back to Alicia to talk about coaching a little bit, why don't you tell us how folks can get in touch with you?
Okay. They can reach me via email at terry.p, P as in Patrick, .conlon, at gmail.com, or terry.conlon@vistagechair.com, all one word. Or they can reach me via phone at 919-274-3693.
All right. Well, let's jump back over. Alicia, you said you wanted to come back to the whole topic of coaching women. So fire away.
Well, sure. Well, I think I'd like to understand what trends you're seeing in this market with women seeking out coaching, and what you think the percentages might be, if you have any guess.
First of all, there's not good market data. So all the data is anecdotal. What I'm seeing is that for the most part, women are more open to group coaching and professional coaching than men are. And I'm not as sure what the causes are, but I'm seeing it happen. And I think that in part it may have to do with the fact that that in many ways, not in all ways, but in many ways, women are more emotionally intelligent than men. So when it comes to group work, and especially when it comes to group coaching, they naturally take to it more so than some men do.
That's interesting. I'm wondering, too, sort of in the background, if it has anything to do with underlying support networks and whether women, you know, is there a difference between the women and the men's support networks day to day? And maybe they're seeking this out more readily because they may feel they don't have that.
They do and they don't. I think that a lot of women are very, very skilled at creating those support networks because they don't exist very easily for them at work. And
right. And
so they build them out from both a professional and personal networking point of view. And so it's a very logical step to move from that to doing more formal coaching because they do a lot of peer coaching, right?
Right. Yep. Yeah, I think one of our women farm leaders has came up a couple of years ago with an idea to develop a women's network. And so the women partners in our firm have put on several events to bring together in-house counsel, women in-house counsel, and they've been very successful. We've gotten very positive feedback on giving folks an outlet and really a network in place where they can call one another and talk to one another. Mm-hmm. And right. And so perhaps we can talk about maybe having you join one of our meetings and talking to us about leadership.
I'd absolutely love to.
That's great.
You know, you both are, you're both working with the largest firm, in your case, in your category, I guess you called it. In Alicia's case, the largest law firm in the Raleigh, in the city of Raleigh. How does it feel to be part of the largest?
It always feels good. It validates your decisions, quite frankly, in some ways. In other ways, sometimes if it gets to be too large, it gets in the way of things. Yeah. But I like to be part of a company, of an enterprise that tries to be the best at, right? And that it's in its DNA.
Yeah, I agree. Smith Anderson has just a longstanding history of having great lawyers on board. And so we have a lot of very smart lawyers, and those folks have really served as a huge foundation for this emerging practice area and others. So from that standpoint, it's a wonderful thing to be in a large firm of quality people. On the other side of that, in a growth area in the legal market, I don't ever really think about we're the biggest because there's always more to do locally, regionally, and nationally in this practice area. And there are certainly a lot of players in this market. So, we stay challenged to grow.
And every client's different anyway.
Yes.
I wanted to come back, Alicia, with you because you mentioned in your bio that you're a member of the Board of Advisors of NCITA. And NCITA is the largest organization in the state of North Carolina representing technology companies. Just tell us a little bit about your role on the Board of Advisors and why do you spend time being a volunteer on the Board of Advisors at NCITA?
Sure. Well, NCITA is a very big organization with lots of high-quality companies that are members. And so the Board of Advisors is really a way to make NCITA smaller and to get to know others on the Board of Advisors. And that gives us the opportunity to attend a lot of networking events that we might not otherwise be able to attend. It gives us the opportunity to serve on certain steering committees that NCITA establishes, including their cybersecurity steering committee, and it's a good channel to make connections with others in the area who are practicing on the same technology, cybersecurity, and data privacy matters that we are. But in general, it's a great organization. They do great things, and Brooks is a wonderful leader for them, and we really enjoy being a part of them.
He is indeed, and I'll just give a little kudo to both Smith Anderson and NCITA on, I believe your firm was a sponsor of the NC Tech Awards the other night.
We were.
And that was a major production.
It was.
First time ever at the Raleigh Convention Center, and I think it really took it up, not a notch, but a bunch of notches, right?
I think so, too. We were there. Yes, we presented an award. I actually presented an award and have done that for the past few years, and it's a fun thing to do in front of a huge audience that
Absolutely.
Seems to grow every year.
Absolutely. And Terry, let's just go back on the on your side to the Vistage chair again. What's your number one job as the chair of the CEO Advisory Board of the Triangle?
The number one job is to keep the Vistage members focused around both the problem solving as well as leadership development that they need to go through. That's it. It's simple. It's not easy, but it's really that simple.
All right. Well, this has been a very interesting show, talking to two folks who are doing very interesting things. I think, you know, both of you are working sometimes one-on-one, sometimes in groups. I think, you know, in some ways we could say that Alicia is coaching as well as advising. And I think in some ways we could say Terry is advising as well as coaching, right?
That's absolutely right.
So I think you're both very much in the same but in very different businesses. So thank you both for sharing your stories here. We really appreciate it. This is what we do on Metro Raleigh Business Radio's Carolina Connections. As I said at the beginning, is we talk with interesting business leaders, and we have you share your stories, and we help you share your stories.
Good deal. Well, thank you, Cal. It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you, Cal.
You're welcome. We enjoyed it. You're welcome.
All
right. Well, we're going to wrap this show up. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in the Wireless Research Center here in Wake Forest, one of our power partners. We'd also like to thank Encita, who's one of our other power partners, and Entredot, our third power partner, for helping us spread the word about what's going on in businesses here in the Metro Raleigh area. We look forward to bringing you another exciting and informative show next week, same time, same place, on Metro Raleigh Business Radio X's Carolina Connections. So on behalf of our guest and our producer, Reed, this is Cal Hackman, your host, and I'm signing off for today. We'll be right back.